Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, March 24th, welcome, friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Happy National Cheesesteak Day to all who celebrate. Right now at the airport, they are trying, or perhaps have already completed their task of creating the world's longest cheesesteak.
All right.
So that's underway at this hour. That's one element of breaking news. The other evolving news story, perhaps a bit more important, is the war in Iran. That's going to be the topic of the show today on Studio 2. What are we doing? What's our goal? What do the various regional players want out of this conflict? How dug in is Iran's current regime? Is there still hope of regime change, which seems to be maybe one of the goals of this war? We have two great experts on the show today, an investigative reporter from the New York Times, a professor of history who has written about American and Iranian relations dating back to the 1700s. So we've got updates, we've got context, and of course we've got you. What's your view on how the war in Iran is unfolding? We'd love to work your voice into the show. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. You can also drop a comment in the chat on YouTube or Facebook. For instance, Sin says, I think we are low-key getting our butts kicked over there. Perhaps you agree with Sin or disagree, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, I would love to get your takes. Again, what's your view on how the war in Iran is unfolding? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we have our trio of local news stories. Kermit Gosnell, the West Philadelphia abortion doctor sentenced to life in prison for murder, died in a Pennsylvania hospital earlier this month. He was 85 years old. Trigger warning for anyone who may not recall Kermit Gosnell. He was accused of regularly performing illegal abortions beyond Pennsylvania's 24-week limit for years in his West Philadelphia clinic. Gosnell's practices were discovered by authorities during a 2010 drug trafficking investigation. And in 2013, he was convicted of murder for killing three babies that had been delivered alive. He was also convicted of manslaughter for the death of a woman who died during an abortion procedure at the clinic. And Gosnell spent more than a decade behind bars. He ultimately died March 1st at a hospital outside of the prison. That's according to a Department of Correction spokesperson. And he was most recently incarcerated at SCI Smithfield, about 60 miles south of Pittsburgh. No word on the cause of death, but Gosnell had portrayed himself as this advocate for poor women in need, but his clinic was called a house of horrors. And Avi, I had been a reporter at the time, and it is definitely a case that we will never forget in this city. I left out a lot of details of how babies were killed in this clinic, but it is definitely very memorable.
Yeah, and became part of the national debate about abortion for clear and obvious reasons. But sort of forgotten in all this was the human tragedy and the failure of the state regulators to identify this. As you mentioned, this came to light during a 2010 drug trafficking investigation. And perhaps we'll never know, because a lot of records were destroyed, exactly how long all of this went on. But I think it's safe to say that it went on for long enough that you would have thought someone in state government in a regulatory role would have noticed or would have raised a red flag. And ultimately, that's a huge part of the story. And there were reforms afterward as a result of this.
A couple people got fired.
Yeah. This horrific case.
Yeah.
Story number two. Look, you might have a vague sense that healthcare is a very important part of our regional economy. You know, meds and eds, right, Cherry? Meds and eds.
We hear that all the time. Yeah.
But federal data collated and analyzed by the Inquirer shows just how dominant the healthcare industry has become. Here are a few stats that are really eye-catching. In Bucks County, healthcare jobs accounted for 95% of all new jobs created over the last decade. Overall, in the Delaware Valley, the healthcare industry has accounted for 70% of new jobs. That is double the national average. And another interesting part of this trend, These jobs are not primarily being created in hospitals. Mm-hmm. They're mostly outpatient jobs in fields like ambulatory care, home health care, home nursing care, etc. So if you want to know, like, what is the backbone of our economy at this point, where is the economic growth? A lot of it is in healthcare, specifically outpatient healthcare. Like, I knew it was a lot. I didn't know it was this much,
yeah.
Jerry.
So interesting, Avi, because that we are seeing the rise of these outpatient jobs in home health care and home nursing care that you mentioned. The article doesn't mention this, but we've talked about it on the show. The Delaware Valley is experiencing a significant demographic shift, with the population age 65 and older projected to increase 31% by 2050. And in Pennsylvania, by 2030, one in three residents will be over 60.
And that's where the demand for these services is.
And Forbes has sort of written about this, how the baby boomer generation, as they age, they are increasing the need for healthcare. And more people are living a lot longer. And they're going to the doctor.
Yep.
They want their healthcare. And so it's reshaping the healthcare landscape. And, you know, we're
reshaping our economy.
It's reshaping our economy, and we're not immune to that here.
Absolutely. And this is the flip side of the healthcare costs are going up coin.
Mm-hmm.
Costs are going up. Now, some of that is the other side of that is job creation. And to the point where you try to imagine what would happen to the economy of Philadelphia if indeed there was a slump in this sector. I mean, it almost reminds me of like how bound up our economy was in manufacturing mm-hmm. and industrial production 100, 150 years ago. And what happened when that went away? Now, there is some concern out there that a lot of these types of jobs, not all of them, but some of these jobs could be automated because of AI. And then what would happen to an economy like Philadelphia's that's so dependent on this type of work and this type of labor? It's just something to think about because we saw what happened with automation when the industrial jobs mostly went away.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because 95% of all new jobs in Bucks County over the past decade in this sector.
95%.
Very, very dependent on this sector. Interesting article there. Our third story, a couple of Drexel scientists. They want your Philadelphia mice.
They want my what?
They want your mice.
They want my mice?
They want the mice.
Want my mice?
The mouse in
they
your house.
They want to get their hands on my mice that I cherish and love?
The mouse in your house. So if you trap a mouse in your house, you don't have to feel bad. They can be used to help advance science. All you got to do is give Drexel a buzz.
Hello, Drexel.
Yeah, cool story about Philly Mag, about two biologists who are looking at the genetic and behavioral differences between city and rural rodents. They believe Philadelphia is an excellent place to find mice.
Apparently, correct. Yes.
We're at the top of the list for most mouse infested cities, right? They've also been collecting mice from New York and Richmond. And they're looking at whether mice adapt to living in cities. Remember Philly's hoagie rat?
I do.
You remember Pizza Rat in New York?
I do.
And they're trying to figure out whether a country mouse would act in the same way, right? So if you can trap or catch a mouse in your house, all you got to do is drop it in a Ziploc bag. You can put it in the freezer. You email wewantmice@gmail.com and somebody will come pick that mouse up from your house.
Wait, say that email address again.
wewantmice@gmail.com.
Now,
real email, according to the article.
These are legit scientists, I'm quite sure.
Yes.
That's a very scammy sounding email address. wewantmice@gmail.com.
Yeah, well, remember, you have to have something catchy so people will remember it.
It's like webuyanycar.com.
Yeah. It would have been better if they say we want show mouse, but, or whatever, but we want mice.
I might have gone with like, mousespecimen@drexel.edu, but okay.
You wanted to sound more science-y.
Yes. Well, this is science, is it
this
not?
This is science.
But they're doing science for the people. I get it.
We are.
So this is about the difference between city mice and country mice.
Yep.
Which I think there was like, I feel like there's been like an animated movie about that. Wasn't that Bible Goes West?
You know what? I think so. Yeah.
So we already know the answer. So we don't even need to do this. No, I'm just kidding. But it sounds like an interesting, and I'm curious because then you could take the conclusions from this.
Mm-hmm.
Extrapolate to humans, right?
Yeah, that's actually right, yeah.
With the idea that what we find in mice about how the city changes them could be the way the city is changing us.
Yeah, I'm definitely a
city
girl.
Is the city changing you?
I'm
like,
but I'm
on a biological level, do you feel it changing you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I
are
feel
you
like,
better adapted?
I feel like I, but I'm a city person. I grew up kind of like a city
right,
person.
Right.
So I don't know what, I don't know how the country would change me, I guess.
Yeah. How would a simple country mouse survive in the city?
A country version of Jerry.
This year from Walt
are
Disney.
Are you a city mouse or a country mouse?
I'm a city mouse.
Yeah,
I'm a
you
South
totally
Philly,
are.
I'm a South Philly
mouse. South Philly all the way. Yeah, so we want your mice. We want mice.
No, not we want your mice.
Let me not mess it up. We want mice at gmail.com.
We want mice at gmail.com. We swear we're 95% sure it's not a scam. We want mice at gmail.com. Our email address is studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the topic of today's show, which is the ongoing war in Iran. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're entering the fourth week of the war in Iran, and President Trump says productive talks with Tehran are underway. On Monday, Trump backed off his threat to destroy Iran's power plant and gave the country a five-day extension to open the Strait of Hormuz. Here's President Trump speaking to reporters in front of Air Force One yesterday.
We'll at some point very, very soon meet. We're doing a five-day period. We'll see how that goes. And if it goes well, we're going to end up with settling this. Otherwise, we'll just keep bombing our little hearts out.
But Iranian officials deny serious peace talks are happening. They accuse Trump of using them as a ploy to lower energy prices and buy time for military planning. And these conflicting messages about a resolution have left markets spinning, with crude oil prices again over $100 a barrel today and the average price for a gallon of gas hitting almost $4.
So nearly a month into this war, are we any closer to a conclusion? And if so, what will have been accomplished? We have two guests to help us wade through these questions. We have Mark Mazzetti, investigative reporter for The New York Times, focused on national security. Mark, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me on.
We also have John Gasvinian, historian and author of America and Iran, A History, 1720 to the Present. John, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have you at home. We want to know, what's your view on how the war in Iran is unfolding? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And Mark, I wanted to start with you because when people hear talks, they hear the word possible deal. Should they be thinking off ramp or should they think this is just another phase in the war?
Well, it's a phase in the sense that there are now talks or the prospect of talks where there weren't in the past few weeks. So that is, I guess, progress to a degree. But the question of, you know, how optimistic anyone should be, you know, we're all still guessing because there is certainly, you know, from the Trump administration's point of view, an eagerness to end the certainly economic deadlock that is going on. The war has gone on in such a way that is contrary to what many people in the White House believed or how it would go. And so there is an eagerness to, you know, have some kind of resolution. But of course, the question is, on what terms? What terms do the United States and Iran potentially agree to? And of course, a huge factor is, would Israel want to go along with it or be forced to go along with it, because they're another key player in the war as well. So it's really too early to say how optimistic we can be. But, you know, the next couple of days are going to be fascinating leading up to, you know, if you keep, you know, hold President Trump to his word, there's four more days until he, you know, enacts his ultimatum.
Yeah. At this point, Mark, do we have any understanding of what the demands are on either side?
You know, we've heard differing sort of proposals. I think we're trying to get clarity on what the demands are. Yesterday, there were some reports out of Iran that there were these sort of maximalist demands of, you know, if there was any ceasefire or resolution to the conflict, you know, there would have to be a number of things, including, you know, all U.S. military withdrawal from the Middle East. So all the bases that where the United States currently is in, the United States isn't going to agree to that. But the United States has some maximalist demands of its own. So, you know, we may be in that phase of everyone with their opening bids, and, you know, we'll see where this goes in the next couple of days.
Yeah. One thing that you reported, Mark, is that there was some, I don't know if you call it optimism or perhaps projection early on before the war started and then in the early days, that if the U.S. and Israel carried out this strike, there would be a popular uprising in Iran that would destabilize and perhaps unseat the regime. And that hasn't played out yet. I'm curious if you could just take us through what the expectations were internally, it sounds like, especially within the Israeli intelligence community, and how that has compared to the reality on the ground so far, Mark.
Yeah, I think it's part of an overall picture of miscalculation that was in Washington and in Israel before the war started about how Iran might respond and also what might happen inside of Iran. So, you know, I certainly, from the United States point of view, there were many, including the president, I believe, who thought that Iran might not do the things it's now doing. They might act in the same way it did after the June war, the so-called 12-day war. So, you know, back down once the United States, you know, does this strike and not close the Strait of Hormuz. Obviously, that hasn't happened. Now, you referenced a story we did over the weekend, which was that there was this view, especially in the Israeli intelligence community, in Mossad, which is their main foreign intelligence service, that Mossad could effectively foment uprising within Iran after a couple days of bombing that would include the killing of the leadership. Now, of course, we saw what happened on the first day. There was the killing of the supreme leader, but we have not seen any kind of uprising, mass protests inside of Iran. So that was a miscalculation on Mossad's part. Now, the question, of course, is why. And, you know, John, who is far more an expert on Iran than I am, but he can speak to that. But there are many reasons for it. But that, again, was this sort of belief among many that this was going to be relatively quick and easy.
Yeah, and I wanted to give you exactly that question, John. So from the outside, and obviously we're not intelligence officers, but from the outside, you could look at it and say, look, there was a popular uprising in Iran. And then there was a military intervention that included the killing, not just of the supreme leader, but several key leaders in the regime. And from the outside, you could look at those two dominoes falling and say, this is going to lead to regime change. So what did we, the Americans and Israel, misunderstand about Iran, John?
The same thing that we've always misunderstood. I mean, I think this is the problem that we have with our Iran narrative fundamentally, is that it's based, unfortunately, in large part on emotionalism and wishful thinking and fantasies. I want to make this very clear. The Islamic Republic is more unpopular than it's ever been. There's no question about that. It is guilty of a whole range of crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes against its own people, human rights abuses. You know, the regime that came to power in the massive popular revolution in 1979 is simply not the same regime of 2026. There's no question that, especially in recent years, its popularity and its kind of reach within Iranian society has plummeted. However, the Islamic Republic is not a house of cards. It's not a kind of brittle kind of apparatus that's about to collapse. This has been a fundamental part of the American narrative on Iran since the revolution. And there's something interesting about a narrative that is so static that, you know, I suppose the idea is that eventually it will become self-fulfilling, that eventually, if you wait long enough, the Islamic Republic will collapse. That is true. Eventually, you know, in the long run, all regimes and all political systems collapse. But this idea that the Islamic Republic is under the threat of imminent collapse, unfortunately, is the product of a certain, you know, very understandable, wishful thinking on the part of certain diaspora
But it looks from the outside, John, like it does feel like something that would be teetering. We saw people in the streets very bravely, knowing that they were in harm's way. That feels like the sign of a regime on the brink. And then, of course, you lose key leaders. Much of your key defensive infrastructure is being bombed. You're on a defensive footing. You're lashing out at allies all over the region. Like, why is it crazy to look at that scenario and not think this is a regime teetering on the brink? Like, what are we missing here, John?
Because the Islamic Republic is much more entrenched than might appear from the outside. You know, it doesn't need the support of the entire population to be able to sustain itself. It has supporters, not huge numbers. It's clearly a minority and a shrinking minority of Iranians who actually support the regime. And of course, it has a growing minority of Iranians who are willing to go out there and risk life and limb to kind of foment a revolution. But somewhere in between those extremes, there is a large, I won't call it a silent majority because I think that's not an accurate comparison, but there is a silent sort of plurality of Iranians who are deeply unhappy with the Islamic Republic, but are not seeing a reason to go out on the streets and risk their lives to try to bring it down. The reasons for that are very complex, and I'm very happy to get into that. But I think that what we see again and again and again, every single time we have a round of protests like this, is we see thousands and then tens of thousands and then maybe hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. But what we have never seen are millions or you know, tens of millions across the country rallying around either a particular opposition leader or, you know, a you know, an obvious revolutionary moment. We've come very close to that, perhaps. But a lot of Iranians have stayed home again and again. And again, I'm happy to kind of go through what I think of some of the reasons for that. And that doesn't mean that the Islamic Republic is popular. It doesn't. It just means that it's not this brittle house of cards that we often seem to want it to see it as. And the, and I'll say this very simply, and it's not a popular opinion, I realize that, nor is it an opinion that I'm happy to hold. But the reality is, if your goal is to bring down the Islamic Republic, and I think that's a perfectly reasonable goal to have, if that is your goal, you have to start by understanding your enemy and understanding why it has managed to endure for as long as it has.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in just a moment. I want to bring in a caller. We have Alex from Montgomery County on the line. Alex, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, ma'am. In 1953, Iran had a democratically elected government. And the USA intervened and toppled that democratic government and installed a dictator called the Shah. And all the past 73 years, we have been responsible for everything that is happening in Iran. And every time we go outside, we mess up and we create a mess and we don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, thank you, Alex, from Montgomery County. Gregory says, leave those people alone. We lost once we dropped that missile on that school, killing 160 girls. That's not what this country is supposed to be about. Our question of the day is, what's your view on how the war in Iran is unfolding? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on Facebook or YouTube, keep those comments coming in the chat. John, I wanted to query you a little bit about the psyche of the people in Iran. I don't think that, you know, a lot of people really understand this. You know, Avi, and you, there was a lot of talk about, you know, the Americans sort of opened the door, and you were alluding to this idea that there are reasons why folks just didn't, you know, sort of take the window, put their life on the line and just seize power there. Could you explain, you know, sort of, who are the factions in Iran and sort of the psyche of why, when given this opportunity, folks did not step up?
Okay, so look, there are a number of reasons for that. We have to start by acknowledging the Islamic Republic, you know, has not hesitated to use extreme brutality to put down protests. That level of fear and that level of security, you know, that level of sort of coercive apparatus is very real. But it's not the only reason that it's managed to preserve itself in power. A state apparatus that has the entire population against it will never be able to sustain itself in power for very long, purely with brutality. The reality is, for a whole range of reasons, up until now, historically, Iranians, have not seen this revolutionary moment. And so one of those reasons is that there isn't a clear opposition leader. There are, of course, Reza Pahlavi, the former crown prince, is out there, making a lot of noise these days. And of course, he has huge numbers of supporters. But he's not really seen by the majority of Iranians as a viable candidate. It's very different from 1979, when you had the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was sort of seen as the obvious sort of leader in waiting of the Iranian revolution. Secondly, Iranians have seen the recent experiences of other regional countries like Syria and Libya, and are very cautious of the idea of their country becoming, balkanized, divided between lots of different rival militias, many of them supported by external factors, external actors like Russia or the United States or China or Israel. Thirdly, I think most Iranians, as much even when you talk to people who truly despise the Islamic Republic and want with all their hearts and souls to bring it down and are willing to risk their lives for it, will say, quite honestly, that they're under no illusions that the United States is somehow, that its heart is bleeding for the Iranian people. There is a nervousness about the idea of being bombed into freedom or into liberation by the United States, especially under the Trump administration. On top of which, the Islamic Republic has also successfully put down roots across all aspects of society over the past 47 years. Yeah, it has large numbers of people on its payroll, or as well as people who have benefited, frankly, from the Islamic Republic. But again, a large percentage of the population, though they might hate the government, they might hate everything that it stands for, have found ways over the past 10, 20, 30, 40, 47 years to kind of live some kind of functional life, a life that's not perfect, but have kind of found ways to sort of make their way. And those people are going to think twice and maybe three times before they pour out into the streets and allow themselves to be mowed down by, regime machine guns, when they don't know that there's a clear alternative in place, a clear opposition leader in place, when this stuff is being potentially led by the United States or Israel. So it's a very complex picture. It's not a simple yes and no, black and white. Is this a are we about to see a revolution or are we not? Iran is a highly divided society with a highly complex political landscape.
Yeah, and the vision of regime change that we've been talking about so far, John, sounds kind of like, look, there's an outside force, mm-hmm. whether it's a civic uprising, maybe it's an armed group that comes in to challenge the regime. But there's an alternate vision, I would imagine, out there, which is that there is internal dissolution within the regime, or perhaps the clerical class stops granting its legitimacy to the regime. And our caller mentioned 1953. And it's perhaps worth noting that at one point in time, there were major clerics who supported Mossadegh and then perhaps drifted from him and supported the CIA and the British intelligence on some level in overthrowing him. And so there is the possibility of a path where there is just a split within the regime. Do you think we're any closer to that today, or are we further away from that?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think what we've seen is the Iranian leadership has learned from its own history. We don't have to like them. But one of the things that the current leadership of the Islamic Republic has learned is from precisely episodes like the one you just described. They've been very good at building loyalty through a whole bunch of mechanisms over the years. And one thing we have simply not seen evidence of is the regime cracking from within.
Yeah.
There's been absolutely no real evidence of that.
Mm. Let me bring in another caller. This is George from Allentown on the line. George, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is basically, I think that modern history has shown that you cannot bomb an opponent into submission or change. It didn't work in World War II. It didn't work in Vietnam when we bombed Hanoi or North Vietnam. And I just don't think that's going to succeed against an opponent who is obviously this committed, rightly or wrongly, to their way.
Yeah.
So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. That's George from Allentown. Mark, I'd love to get your reaction to what George had to say. And then also your thoughts on, given now what this administration has sort of realized about the determination of this regime, the complexity of the feelings of the Iranian Iranian people, what are the options on the table?
Well, first to the question from the caller, it's been documented, I guess, that that there's never been a successful, quote, regime change operation that's been done entirely from the air. So in other words, you're trying to use bombing, as the caller pointed out, in order to affect a different government on the ground. And so far, that is proving the case after 3 weeks of this war. If you look back to the first day of the conflict when President Trump came out in his video message, that was the closest an American official has basically said, our goal here is regime change. And remember what he said was he basically said, you know, if you're the military in Iran, you know, lay down your weapons. And of course, the question is, to whom, right? I mean, who are you laying down your weapons to when there's no invading force? There's no mass uprising. He said for the Iranian people to take to the streets. Well, as John pointed out, while there's still bombing going on and while the regime is in place, you would take very, very great risks to take to the streets if you're an Iranian citizen to sort of try to engage in protest because the regime has not shown it is likely to collapse. So that is the point of the if the goal is, of course, regime change, then they had some basic assumptions about this that at this point seem to be incorrect. Now the question is, so now what?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're at this point where there is certainly a great amount of pressure on by, you know, the global financial system, the economic system, right, to make sure that this doesn't last in perpetuity, that, you know, shipping in the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz is stopped for basically Western ships, right, that is wreaking havoc on markets, right, and this is pressure on the White House. And so I do think that the Trump administration is feeling that and looking for possible resolutions, right, that when we look at the goals are not necessarily what President Trump laid out on the first day. They are more limited goals. They are goals that talk about, you know, degrading the missile facilities of Iran, degrading the nuclear facilities, destroying the Navy, allowing shipping to go through the Strait of Hormuz, limiting Iran's ability to use proxy forces around the Middle East. This is not regime change, right?
Yeah.
And as I said in the beginning, the question, though, is if there is this eagerness to find resolution in Washington, how is the dynamic also playing out in Israel, right? Which if this regime or, you know, a large portion of the regime is in power at the end of this war, certainly it will be seen by many Israelis as a failure.
And on top of that, your colleagues today at the New York Times, Mark, reported that Saudi Arabia... Now, Saudi Arabia denies this, but Saudi Arabia is behind the scenes pushing for continued intervention, more aggression from the U.S., perhaps pushing toward regime change. Where does Saudi Arabia fit into this entire equation? Because they're a little bit more under the surface because they're not the ones like Israel out there conducting the aggression and the bombing. But they're a huge regional player. What do they want and why would they want the U.S. to push further into this conflict, Mark?
Well, I mean, the Saudi calculus is very complicated. And, you know, if you go back just a few years, it was there was this sort of grand vision of the Middle East where Israel was becoming closer to Arab countries, their traditional adversaries, and the prospect of normal relations with Saudi Arabia, between Saudi Arabia and Israel, right? And that was basically meant as a way to line up against Iran because they were seen as the real regional foe. But since the October 7th attacks in Israel by Hamas, that scrambled things to the point where that reconciliation seems less and less likely. And so you are not going to see Saudi Arabia necessarily normalize relations with Israel without a Palestinian state. But what that means, though, is that they are still ultimately, they see Iran as an adversary. Obviously, Iran has been attacking Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabian institutions, cities, oil facilities. And they want, at this point, according to our reporting, they want resolution in the sense of get this regime out of power.
Because so they're going to turn around, they're going to be mad, and then they're going to further attack us or try to somehow undermine us. That's the worry on Saudi Arabia's
part.
Yeah,
that the events of the last 3 weeks have
they've kicked the hornet's nest. Yeah.
Yes. And but you know, it's they ultimately want regional stability more than anything else, and I guess they're making the calculation that that only comes with an end to the regime in Iran.
Mm. So many dynamics at play. And on the other side of this break, I wanted to get into more of like who the factions are within our own administration, mm-hmm. who's pushing for off ramps and who's pushing for, you know, further hostilities to try to get to some sort of maximalist resolution. We, of course, want to hear your thoughts as you've been giving them to us all hour. What's your view on how the war in Iran is unfolding? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We are talking about the ongoing war in Iran and unpacking how it's playing out compared to the Trump administration's original goals. And also what it's meant for the people on the ground in Iran. Let me reintroduce our guests. We have Mark Mazzetti, national security reporter for The New York Times, and John Gasvinian, historian and author of America and Iran, A History, 1720 to the Present.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. A question of the day is, what's your view on how the war in Iran is unfolding? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Sid says, success looks like this. Declare objectives met and cease hostilities. What this war is accomplishing is terrorizing the region on all sides, including Israel, and distracting from Epstein. That's Sid's comment. John, there must be people within Iran who are deeply concerned about what the future looks like after this war, whenever it ends. We've been talking about sort of the U.S. failures and miscalculations, but at the end of this, Iran comes out of this, I would imagine, with a great deal of human and physical destruction, a regime that's going to possibly be further isolated from its neighbors, that it's just started, that it's been bombing and drone attacking. Assuming the regime makes it through this war, like, what is the day after for Iran, John?
I mean, that is the great tragedy of this war. I mean, the by far the largest price will be paid, has already been paid by the Iranian people. And God knows how much more of a price they might still pay in the days and weeks to come. We've had hundreds of lives lost, buildings, homes, schools destroyed, historic architecture destroyed. And on top of which, it only looks like, if anything, the regime is even more entrenched than it was before. And if the Islamic Republic does come out of this, living to fight another day, it's only going to feel highly vindicated. It's going to be one of a series of tremendous asymmetrical victories against the United States that date back to Vietnam. And, you know, the Islamic Republic, its propaganda will go into overdrive on this to say, look at what we did, despite years of the most brutal, crippling sanctions that have ever been placed on a country during peacetime, despite having, you know, huge military bases arrayed around us, or despite all the world superpowers aligned against us and so on, and Israel and this, that, and the other thing, we managed to survive. Despite endless, you know, kind of attempts by the United States to and Israel to stir up domestic tensions, et cetera, et cetera. And that's going to be the narrative. And that, you know, is to, if you're the Trump administration, it seems to me the worst possible outcome.
And your best guess, John, does that narrative then translate to a committed reconstruction of its missile program and its nuclear program?
Those are the fantastic questions. I mean, the nuclear program or at least nuclear enrichment on Iranian soil is an absolute red line of the Islamic Republic, and frankly, of any Iranian government that's likely to follow it, including, I mean, a lot of one of the ironies is a lot of the most senior officials in the Shah's regime from before 1979, those who were still around, have spent a lot of time over the past few years saying we would have done the exact same thing when it comes to the nuclear program. Mm. For Iran, the issue is not, and this gets into a tremendously complex issue, but you know, we often focus on the potential of a weaponization of its program. But for Iran, there is an ironclad principle of enrichment on its own soil, and that has to do with its own independence and its security. That the one time we made any kind of breakthrough with Iran on its nuclear program under the Obama administration was because we recognized that, and we baked that into the agreement. Of course, we know what happened to that agreement, but I don't think that those red lines are going to change under any kind of circumstance. Mm.
Yeah. Mike from Germantown says Iran is a theocracy. They made it clear that if you are not one of them, you are subject to execution. And now adding their nuclear enrichment, that poses a threat to neighboring countries with other religious affiliations like Israel. Mark, I'd love to get your thoughts, because on the U.S. side, I mean, hearing what John just said, there's this red line in the sand. What does the U.S. need to get from this to make it worth it to people who are saying to them, we wasted our time, we're wasting money, we wasted U.S. lives? I mean, how does this Trump administration try to save face and pull back out of this? What does it need to accomplish to make it all worth it?
Well, I think it's hard to find consistency in President Trump's comments about Iran in the last year and a half. But I mean, one thing that he has said fairly consistently, right, is that we will not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, right? Or the United States will not, and he will not. So, you know, if you're the Trump administration and you're somehow looking for a way out of the war and declaring victory, even though there is a regime in place that is, you know, fundamentally the same as it was, you know, they would probably, my guess is, make the case that, you know, the nuclear facilities are fairly destroyed. The enrichment abilities of Iran are destroyed. And so they're not making a bomb anytime soon. Now, there's this question, and this has been in the press a lot, of the already enriched uranium that is in Iran. What happens to that? And can you end the war where Iran still holds its highly enriched uranium that it could then be used in some short order to, you know, get to weapons grade and build a bomb or some kind of a device? And that is, I think, one question is, could the Trump administration declare victory when Iran is still in possession of this highly enriched uranium? So the end game for the Trump administration really does seem to focus around the military and the state of the nuclear program. Mm. If you ask the Israelis, they would put it differently, because they've said long, they've long said that their biggest concern is the proxy forces Iran has, as well as its missile program that is quite capable, as we've seen, of hitting Israel and many other countries in the region. And as long as that this capability still exists at the end of the war, then Israel would certainly see this as not a victory in the conflict.
How close are we, Mark, to troops on the ground, do you think, at this point? There's been little talk of this, some parts of the 82nd Airborne Division and Karg Island, which, as you mentioned earlier, is a key point in the transportation of energy in that region, sort of a way station. I mean, do you have a sense, Mark, that we're getting kind of close to that scenario playing out, or does it still feel like a distant possibility, actual significant numbers of boots on the ground?
Well, it's so hard to know now what the military preparations mean in terms of the actual planning or the threat of force, right? So we see, as you said, Marines moving to the region. There have been reports of special operations troops training in the region and moving more to the region around, you know, again, around these possible operations, either to get highly enriched uranium, as I just discussed, or to seize parts of Iran along the shoreline of the Persian Gulf that would allow the shipping to continue and sort of seizing Iranian oil facilities. Like, these are the things that have been discussed. And the question of, I think it's impossible to say right now how close we are, but certainly if whatever talks that are going on right now don't amount to anything, and the status quo continues, then the president will face this question of, well, how is he going to change the dynamic? And there will be some of his advisors who are pushing him, who will push him towards greater military action, i.e. American boots on the ground, with all sorts of possibilities and consequences that we could discuss.
I guess I'm a little confused, Mark, about why someone in the administration, let's say there's a faction in the administration that wants this to end quickly, which there must be, why they couldn't go to Trump and say, look, you're the master of spin. Just spin it. Get out of there and spin it and say you did what you wanted to do. Now it's there for the rest of the region to hash it out. We gave you guys sort of a clean slate. Go at it. I just feel like maybe I'm being too simplistic about what that exit ramp looks like, but it feels like it's right there. Am I wrong, Mark?
Well, I'm not sure that isn't happening, right? That some aren't saying that, you know, the time to declare victory is now or was yesterday, right?
Yeah.
Because if you look at, for instance, you know, the goals that, you know, Secretary of State Marco Rubio always lays out, which is like four very defined goals. And if you take those four defined goals, again, around the Navy and the ballistic missile program, the nuclear facilities, like, if you took those and sort of check boxes, you could, if you're the president, as you said, make a case, well, we've achieved our goals, it's time to move on.
Yeah.
And you just said he could potentially spin that, but I think one thing that we also have to think about is, you know, Iran has recognized the leverage that it has in this.
Yep.
And that what it has done is effectively brought the oil economy to a halt just by virtue of its own geography. And if the war were to, say, end today with everything in place, Iran has its deterrence of being able to do that again, to yep. close the Strait of Hormuz, you know, and to keep Israel or the United States from ever attacking again. So it's its own sort of, it's ensuring its own survival because it has shown the leverage. It's able to use the leverage and it will use it again. So that would be the argument for not ending it now, because you're basically saying, you know, Iran could ensure that something like this will never happen again.
Yeah. And John, I want to bring you back in the conversation because, I mean, Al Jazeera had released this video earlier this week reporting that a spokesman for the IRGC central headquarters had taken jabs at President Trump. We saw that they were giving, you know, very opposite messaging to the Trump administration. Your take on that and how that is likely to influence these negotiations as I'm sure they are probably maybe even looking for an off-ramp as well.
It's interesting because that same spokesman today came out and said, look, we are securing the Strait of Hormuz under our own firepower and our own capabilities, and we will not and do not need to be laying mines and so on, or we will be able to secure that, you know, in our own way, which I actually read, you know, I mean, I think as Iran's own sort of testing the waters of a sort of de-escalation. They were basically saying, look, you know, we're not going to fundamentally continue to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. We can continue to, we you know, we sort of made our point. You know, the situation reminds me a lot of 1982. And let me say what I mean by that. It's the sort of thing you'd expect a historian to say. you know, about 2 years into the Iran-Iraq war, it's a very similar situation. Iran, even though everyone in the world hated Iran, there was still a begrudging acknowledgement of the fact that Iran had been the victim of the Iran-Iraq war, at least of the Iraqi invasion, Saddam Hussein's invasion in September of 1980. And that, you know, 1 or 2 years into it, Iran had actually managed to hold Saddam's Iraq to its side of the border. and had an opportunity to end the war right then and there. And it didn't. They got a little too cocky. They overplayed their hand. And the war perpetuated for another 6 years at a tremendous cost to both Iranians and to Iraqis. That was under the more radical leadership of the Ayatollah Khomeini. I actually think that this generation of Iranian leaders, I could be wrong, but I think that they probably learned from that history, because a lot of them, frankly, fought in that war, and recognize that they should be careful about overplaying their hand, at least in the last couple of weeks. Again, we're in a situation where no one likes Iran, no one likes their government, but there is this kind of begrudging acknowledgement of the reality that they have been the victim of, you know, foreign aggression in this war. If they are able to shut down the Strait of Hormuz for a number of days, make their point, get the Trump administration to climb down and still stay in power, that would be a very smart move for them. And I would be surprised if they don't take that opportunity. If they don't, frankly, that means that they're repeating their own mistakes from 1982. And I have a feeling that they probably learned some of those lessons.
Well, we learned a lot of lessons this hour from both of you, and let me thank you again. That's John Gazvinian, professor of history and author of America and Iran, A History 1720 to Present. John, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And let me also thank Mark Mazzetti, investigative reporter for The New York Times, focused on national security. Mark, thank you so much for the insights this hour.
Thank you.
And let me read a few more of your comments. Stephen says, millions of Americans want the current president out of power. Iranians want those in power in their country to depart. We shouldn't wag our fingers at Iranians until we are ready, willing, and able to take action in our own country. Brian says, where's Doge when we need them? Mm-hmm. This war is Trump's. It's a complete waste of taxpayer dollars. The reason for the war is totally fraudulent. This is also another blatant abuse of power by Trump. And finally, these are all one note. That's what the comments were today.
Yeah.
Stan says the war against Iran is a mess. Yesterday, Trump said negotiations with Iran were promising, and he promised to stand down on infrastructure attacks. Iran said Trump's lying, and this morning it launched more rockets at Israel.
Yeah, thank you to everybody who wrote in today. And thank you to our folks who called in and gave great comments on the phone as well. And of course, we couldn't do any of what we do without thanking our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Michael Schiffler engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you tomorrow.